$350 Swiss.
高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高
高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高
高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高
高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高高When you think of a bank, you probably think of scenes like this. People putting their money into a safe place for a rainy day, or taking out loans if they need money for whatever reason. But in most cases, you think of a bank as looking after other people's money in some way. When most people hear the term investment bank, they likely have some notion that an investment bank is somehow involved in either of these two activities. But this is not the case. Investment banks do not make their money from buying low and selling high, or indeed from looking after other people's money. Here are some investment banks that you may have heard of: Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Citi, Deutsche Bank, Barclays, UBS, and Credit Suisse. These are the biggest ones, but there are others. Also, some of these companies also run retail banks and commercial banks. Barclays, for example, here in the UK, is a big bank on the high street, but their investment banking wing is a separate operation, which by law must be run as a separate division. So anyway, what does an investment bank do? This very handy graphic from Wall Street Prep explains it all rather well. But before we explore it in detail, there are some key terms and concepts that you need to know. Now, in the world of finance, there is some jargon that can be quite confusing to people who are not familiar with it. First, there is the primary market, which is where companies look to raise capital, whether through direct investment. That means a venture capital firm pledges money directly in exchange for some return at a future date, or through taking out loans, or much more commonly, through issuing new shares to be traded publicly on the stock market. All these activities are part of what is called the primary market. Another activity that takes place in the primary market is mergers and acquisitions. That is, if one company buys another company and or wishes to merge their operations into one big company. Then there is the secondary market, which is the exciting world of trading that you imagine from popular culture. This is where millions of trades every day take place in a number of different asset classes. Now, in the jargon of finance, such tradable assets are called securities. These include stocks or equities, which are shares in companies, bonds or fixed income investments, which are also called debt securities, the FX markets, which is basically just trading different currencies from around the world, for example, buying American dollars with British pounds, derivatives, which are short-term contracts used to hedge against various risks, which include things like commodities futures, for example, buying a pledge for a certain amount of grain in the future for a fixed price. And very often these are traded at high frequency. And there's also real estate, which is just buying and selling land in the real world. There is also, in contrast to securities, commodities, which are real physical objects like precious metals or oil, which are also traded. Now, in both of these worlds, the world of the secondary market and the world of the primary market, in the jargon of finance, there are firms on the buy side and firms on the sell side. These terms can be confusing to some people because they imagine it means that one side is buying and the other side is selling, when in actuality, it is only the buy-side firms that are engaged in making money by buying low and selling high, or by making shrewd longer-term investments. Buy-side firms include asset management firms of every type, hedge funds, mutual funds, and private equity firms. All these firms are involved in making investment decisions on behalf of their clients. So what does the sell-side do? Well, let's deal with the world of trading first. That's the secondary market. In most exchanges in the world, asset management firms from the buy side will have their traders on the floor looking to buy and sell. In the old days, it was a lot of shouting and activity. These days, it's more likely to be a bunch of people looking at screens and clicking on a mouse. But fundamentally, they are engaged in the same activity. However, they cannot simply just trade with other buy-side firms. They must be brought together by a broker. And this is where the sell side comes in. The broker executes the trade by taking a buy or sell order from the trader. The broker takes a fee for performing this service. The broker has no stake in the actual trade. They are purely facilitating it as a middleman. While not all brokers are investment banks, this brokerage service has been a long part of the core business of what investment banks do. In effect, whether their client has just made $1 million or just lost $1 million, the broker still makes money through the fee. In other words, whether the market is up or down, firms like Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan still make money no matter what, because they are simply selling their access to the market. It is a requirement by law that trading firms must access the exchanges through a broker in this way due to a special license they hold. And such licenses in both America and in Europe are subject to strict regulations, which means they are not easy to obtain even by very wealthy companies. There are approximately 3,000 broker firms in the world, but the biggest and best known are the investment banks. Morgan Stanley executes around 18% of all the equities trades in the world. Goldman Sachs executes around 16% of them, and JP Morgan around 13%. Now consider, there are millions of trades made every second, and consider also the scale of the income. Morgan Stanley just made $1 million, and again, and again, and again. Oh, and there again, they made another $1 million just through the fees of executing these trades. And the same goes for all these other investment banks. So Goldman Sachs, so here's $1 million, and again, and again, and again. And this is just the sales and the trading side of the business. It strikes me that a combination of sheer mass and scale and regulations fix these firms in place as a permanent part of the structure of the market. The investment banks have become a fundamental part of its very architecture. Now let's move on to the primary market. This is where companies, any corporations out there in the real world, that is, the ones you've heard of, you know, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and so on, want to raise capital for any reason. And the other core business of the investment bank is facilitating this process. If a company wishes to issue new shares, in the parlance, this is called an IPO, an initial public offering, they must, mandated by law and held in place by heavy regulations, do it through an institution which has the correct set of licenses to do so. And you guessed it, such institutions are indeed the investment banks. In exchange for a fee, which can be anywhere between 3% and 7% of the total money raised, the investment bank brings the new shares to the market and sells them to investors. The issuing company gets all of the money minus the fee, and the investors get the shares. The investment bank gets the fee. So anytime a company issues new stocks or bonds, the investment banks get another payday. And this is also how government bonds are released onto the market as well. By the way, I have another video all about them if you'd like to learn more. Anyway, as you can see here, it is the same companies who dominate this market. JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and so on and so forth. Although, as you can see from this second graphic, the precise market share seems to change on a quarterly basis. And then, on top of all this, there is the mergers and acquisitions business, in which Again, because they happen to hold the correct set of licenses mandated by law and heavy regulations, investment banks must facilitate, again, in exchange for a fee. And they perform this service whenever one company wants to buy another. And as in the other cases, it is the same few firms who have this sector on lockdown in terms of their market share. Although also in this case, the precise numbers vary from quarter to quarter. So to sum up, investment banks make their money almost exclusively through fees for performing any of their various services. The core ones being executing trades on financial exchanges, distributing new shares following an IPO, and new bonds, whether from companies or governments. And finally, through facilitating mergers and acquisitions. Whenever there's a trade, whenever there are new shares or bonds bought, whenever there's a merger and acquisition, an investment bank is making money. Now, somewhat controversially, especially for a classical liberal like me, I believe that these investment banks are so big and so ingrained in the fundamental structure of these markets and have enjoyed state-backed protection through regulation for such a long period that they are no longer private companies in the same way that you think, for example, of a farmer who owned his own farm. Lots of my libertarian friends disagree with this, but this farmer could only be comparable to Goldman Sachs if the government said that you could only buy milk, meat, and eggs from him because he has a set of special licenses for it. Maybe there are a dozen or so other special farmers with these special licenses also to give the illusion of some competition. But when 18% of all milk sales come from this farmer, is it because he's more productive as a farmer and that he offers, you know, better milk than all the other farmers and all the other potential farmers out there? Or is it because of his special status as a milk license holder? Whenever there's milk bought, whenever there's meat bought, whenever there are eggs bought, this special license holding farmer makes money. And this is what we'd call in any other line of work a state-backed cartel, which is exactly what the investment banks have become. I hope you see my fundamental issue with this, regardless of who actually owns them, which, as I've explained in other videos recently, is a very widely dispersed ownership among thousands and thousands of individual shareholders, somewhat divorced and separate from the actual control vested in the executive boards of these companies. And this is also quite apart from the fact that some of these firms were bailed out back in 2008 by the American government. My argument rests exclusively on the fact that they are only as big as they are because they are held in place by very strict regulations. Regulations which mean even if they are not a formal part of the state, they are a de facto part of the state. Let me know what you think. Now get out.